Hi everyone, welcome back to the Earthdawn Survival Guide, the podcast for all disciplines, paths, players, and game masters, with requesters Josh and Dan. I am Dan.
I am Josh.
And on today's podcast, we will be discussing all things quizzical and sylvological, because we're going to talk about what it's like to survive in the jungle, and cue your CCR or your Guns N' Roses, take your pick, for the theme song of tonight's show. We're not going to put it in there because we don't want to get sued for copyright infringement, so just play it in the background of your own, wherever you are. Anyway, if you have any questions for us, because we have two emails to get to, if you have any questions for us, please drop us a line at edsgpodcast@gmail.com. Yes, yes, sylvology, the study of jungles and woods. So, sylvological, because I had to look that one up real quick. Anyway, first...
Oh, it makes sense. I mean, it seems like a perfectly cromulent
yes.
word.
Hi, Dan and Josh. The description of the penalty given for wounds in the player's guide, page 381, says they apply to all tests, air quotes. On page 240, blood wounds are related to normal wounds with the sentence, blood wounds are otherwise treated as normal wounds, affecting the character's action tests and abilities to heal damage. See wounds in the combat chapter, page 381. Can you clarify which tests general wounds apply to? Is it only action tests, or is it all tests, including effect tests, i.e. damage, initiative, etc., but not recovery, because that's different? Thank you for the wonderful podcast, Brendan.
Thank you, Brendan. Probably not to everybody's 100% satisfaction, including my own. The easiest part of that is that, yes, recovery tests are specifically called out to be handled by wounds in a specific way. That is that the result is reduced by the number of wounds as opposed to the step of the test itself, which is what all of the other penalties are. However, I double-checked with Morgan. This is a question that comes up not infrequently. And really, the feeling is that it should probably just be action tests. Part of the problem, however, is that due to something of the legacy nature of the language of the game, it's not 100% clearly defined what is an action test versus an effect test. It's similar to what sort of things were going on with the action types, like simple versus free versus standard actions. My feeling is I don't really like the idea of something being penalized twice, double dipping on the penalties. And so what you decide are action tests ultimately would fall down to what you and your table can kind of agree on that. Some things are fairly straightforward, like melee weapons, spell casting,
yeah,
climbing, various tests where you are actually trying to accomplish a thing, where you are trying to actually do an action, should be penalized. But say the actual spell effect, if you roll the spell effect for a successful spell, or the damage test from successfully hitting with
a weapon,
melee weapons, you already got the penalty by trying to do the hit. It doesn't seem particularly fair to me to also then penalize the damage as well.
I agree.
Because then that's making the penalties from wounds even more nasty than they already are.
Because damage really shouldn't be an action. Damage is just a result of an action.
Right. And therefore, sort of the effect of the successful action of hitting somebody with your sword.
Yeah.
The issue is that there are some other things that are actions where the character is trying to do something, but rather than determining the success or failure of the action, the die roll is still just creating a result.
Yeah.
Is initiative an action test or an effect test? Because it's really just generating a number. Value to determine what order things go in.
Yeah.
Should initiative be penalized by wounds? I could see argument cases both ways. And so really what would need to be done, and there is no real indication that this is going to be happening anytime soon, is to go through everything and be a lot more clear about which tests would be action tests and which ones would be effect tests, essentially, and which ones would be resistance tests to actually kind of break those up. Like the test that you make when you are poisoned, the poison resistance test that you make at the beginning of the round when you're going to be affected to see if you shake off the effects of the poison.
Yeah.
That is a test that you are rolling to see if you succeed, but having that be penalized, for example, by whatever penalties you might have can kind of send you into a nasty spiral where each time you fail, your penalties get bigger and therefore it gets harder and harder to succeed. It's similar to like the willpower tests that you might need to make to throw off certain effects on you. I think it's one of those things that for right now, at least, every table is going to have to negotiate that gray area line. Some things are pretty clearly penalized by it. Other things probably shouldn't be pretty clearly, but there is a fairly wide, nebulous gray zone between those things where every table and every group is going to need to figure out where they are comfortable doing that and should be open to renegotiating that as circumstances require.
Dictate. Yeah. I'd say straight initiative probably wouldn't necessarily need to be penalized, but if you're using a talent for initiative like air dance or anticipate blow, probably.
And that's just it is, you know, you have cases like there are talents that substitute for or provide bonuses to a resistance test, like Lionheart, for example.
Yeah.
Would that, because you are rolling a talent as opposed to making just a straight attribute test, would the talent be penalized and the attribute not? And why?
Exactly.
You need to kind of figure out where your own line of comfort and
logic
and game world mechanic simulation comfort level lies. I think ultimately my guiding principle would be a single action, a single thing that your character is doing should not be penalized multiple times by it. So if you are trying to hit somebody with a sword, the action test is trying to hit them with your sword. If you succeed, then the damage test should be normal. The damage test then shouldn't also be penalized by
because that wound. Your likelihood of success getting additional successes is lessened because you're down the number of steps that you're down.
Right.
So probably your damage is going to be normal in the first place. So yeah, I agree. You shouldn't double ding you on that.
But again, everybody has their own levels of comfort. Everybody has different goals and objectives and whatever that they're trying to get out of the game. There's guidelines that we can provide, but there are not really clear dividing lines and categories. And one of the things, unfortunately, that ends up happening anytime that you try and get additional clarity into a game is it expands the amount of rules and explanation that are required, and in some ways ends up making the game more complex, perhaps, than it needs to be.
Yeah, in that case, it just makes it cumbersome.
That's an entirely other discussion when it comes to the philosophy of role-playing design.
Oh, I agree. It's find your balance.
So I hope that was a... I hope that was a mostly satisfactory answer.
We'll get there. We'll find out if it generates other questions. You know where to get a hold of us. EDSGpodcast@gmail.com. Okay, second up email. Hey, Dan. Hey, Josh. I run 1879. Why he's emailing us, I have no idea. I'm just kidding.
Because they don't have a podcast yet.
Oh, dang it. Shame on them. And have run 1879 for a couple of years now and just started up an Earthdawn game again. Feeling good about this one finally making it to Journeyman tier. I have a couple of questions and or thoughts. I don't have a character voice in mind for this email. Ooh, I get to do a character voice. So you can read it as a Midwestern farmer who is a little embarrassed by all the attention. I'll see what I can do with that direction. Are y'all going to have Brad on the show to talk 1879? Maybe to coordinate with an 1879 Kickstarter? Tell him you'll let him talk about trains, and I'm sure he'd agree to.
It's not a bad idea.
Fair. Some cross-referencing.
I'll be seeing Brad in a couple of weeks here.
Gen Con.
At Gen Con. And I know that they are gearing up. They've got some products that are ready, and they are looking at where in the production schedule and whatnot the Kickstarter for those is going to run. So maybe Brad is super busy.
As are you.
As am I. But we'll have to see if something can be worked out. It's not a bad idea. We haven't really focused a lot on much at all on 1879, in part because I'm kind of familiar with the setting and I've run it a couple of times, but it is not a game that I am particularly familiar with. And so maybe having Brad on the show to talk about it would be worthwhile.
Yeah. I haven't picked up any of the books yet because my budget doesn't allow for that, but I will get there soon. So back to the email. Our Earthdawn game is set post-war, pre-empty thrones. I like all the nuanced politics, but I do miss the terrifyingly powerful big bad that was the Theron Empire. The Iopans are deliciously evil and fun to hate, but they aren't powerful enough. Even in Jarrus and Kratos, they don't get clean wins. When are they going to conquer Trevar or Thrall? It feels like the Therons have been defanged and the horrors are weakened. Then, while the Denarastas are individually nasty, the city-state at large doesn't have enough oomph.
That's a fair assessment.
So when are they going to conquer Trevar or Thrall?
They're not going to. Question. So the Denarastas, broadly speaking, don't conquer the way that the Therons do. The Therons conquer an area by
brute force.
Brute force by landing an airship on a place, marching troops in, bombarding it from Kilas and various things like that.
Yeah, very old-fashioned military tactics.
The sort of Roman Empire kind of thing. Very militaristic, very traditional empire in that regard. The Denarastas conquer a place not so much through military might, but through subterfuge and co-option. And while that does allow for its own style of plot and its own attitude towards things, it does allow for a certain amount of brittleness when it comes to their plots. Like the issue with Jarrus, for instance, is that while they have a fairly decent stranglehold on the higher level power structures of Jarrus, they don't have the generations of indoctrination that the city of Iopos has had in order to keep that population in check. And so you get those rebels, you get those malcontents, you get those folks who bristle under the evils of the Denarastas rulership, proxied or otherwise. So if enough force is leveraged against them, they can be taken over. I don't know that I would say that the Denarastas didn't get a clean victory in Kratos. They maybe didn't accomplish everything that they wanted, but they certainly accomplished the major point of their
goal
operation there, which was to unseat Garlthic as the ruler of Kratos, or the de facto ruler of Kratos. The fact that Garlthic didn't die is because Garlthic is an ancient and canny individual and knows when to cut and run rather than to stay and fight for something.
Yeah, he's not going to die on that hill.
Yeah, he's not going to. His magic and philosophy do not allow him ultimately to care enough to die for that.
No, no.
Ultimately, his own survival is above any other benefit that he may have.
Yeah, Garlthic's not going to be a martyr.
And so while Garlthic is in the wind, the situation in Kratos is, as a result of what happened, pretty unstable. And that leaves things ripe for the Denarastas to potentially move in or to back another faction to end up in charge of things.
Yeah.
The horrors, I don't know that we kind of addressed this specifically.
Yeah, I don't think they're defanged. I just...
Well, the issue with the horrors is that quite frequently the horrors as an opponent tend to be a little bit more personal, just in terms of what they're up to.
Yeah.
Their plots and activities, aside from some individuals like, say, Bone Crown the Usurper, they tend to be operating in smaller areas or targeting individuals, and so do not tend to have the larger scale political upheaval potential that the Theron Empire or the Denerastus or Thrall or whatever would potentially be able to have. So you end up with villages, towns, isolated communities that tend to be afflicted by them. But also on the flip side of that, in an actual campaign, a horror is going to be an enemy, an adversary, an opponent that ends up being a lot more tailored and customized for the individual game. Even if you are using a pre-statted named horror, the way that they are going to be involved in a campaign is going to be different than you would otherwise have. I think part of the issue with that as well is that the later developments in first edition, the books in the latter half of Earthdawn's original development cycle, did a lot of expanding of the powers and politics of Barsave. And aside from a couple of the adventures like Shattered Pattern and the individual Parlaenth adventures or Blades, don't tend to have a lot of shaking up the political landscape thing when it comes to horrors. Blades is probably the closest one that's kind of involved with that because of how closely it's tied to the Orc Nation of Carafad. But even that isn't one that is really disrupting the status quo when it comes to the Orc Nation's relationships with other powers and whatnot. It is something that I'm aware of, the horrors not necessarily being as large a presence, the horrors not having so much of a strong, for lack of a better term, campaign presence when it comes to official stuff, although one could argue that some of the stuff that's going on with the Legends of Barsave adventures is kind of horror-centric, but again, not province-wide political shakeup. It's something that I'm aware of and am hoping in some capacity to bring a little bit more to the forward. The Therons are still around. It's just that their military presence within Barsave is greatly reduced because they don't really have a base of operations to have troops stationed out of. And so as we are looking at and talking about future development of Barsave, the Therons can certainly be a player in future events that happen. It's just a matter of finding the right ones and how they would be involved. One of the things that's kind of nice in a sense about Europa is that there is a pretty significant Theron embassy in the city of Europa. And Europa is also as well close to at least one major notable horror corrupted area. And so those are ideas and themes that may potentially show up within that book, depending on what actually ends up in there and what might end up getting cut. These are ideas that I personally am aware of and recognize because they are still cool and still an aspect of the Earthdawn world. It's just a matter of figuring out the best way to deal with them.
Well, I don't think the horrors have been defanged. I think the presence has been lessened because originally when Earthdawn came out, you had two major Therons, obviously the big bad guys, and you had horrors as the big bad guys. The Denerastus were not developed enough. And so I think that the playing field has been leveled as far as the matter of what kind of opposition you can now throw at your party. You've got another tool in your kit. You've got the Denerastus, and you have the Therons, and you have the horrors. And so it's I think, a leveling of each, not necessarily that we took away from one, but we've added to one. So instead of having the Valley of the Denerastus not being developed enough, we've brought them up to a level playing field along with the horrors and the Therons. And so now we've got three equal participants, probably, instead of having just two major ones, now we've got three.
Yeah, it's just that the, certainly in more recent books in our development on fourth edition,
yeah,
the horrors and the Therons have not really featured as anything that is significant within those areas, which is perfectly fair, and I recognize that. And it's also something that was not, certainly the horrors were not a significant development focus in the latter half of the original line because of the story that was going on with the Therons. And I think another thing with the Therons that I've probably mentioned on the show before is that the Therons probably have a situation going on where they're reconsidering their approach to Barsave. Barsave is significant in some respects to the origins and founding of the Theron Empire, but the Therons also have lots of other territory that they have to deal with, and their efforts to militarily conquer Barsave have not been hugely successful. They basically had two military campaigns. They had the original, the first Theron War, where they first returned after the Scourge, and Barsave stood up against them. And then they had the success of the Landing of Triumph and the Battle of Prajor's Field, where they reestablished a certain amount of dominance. But then there was the second Theron War, when, backed by the dragons and sort of prodded and manipulated by the dragons, Barsave then banded together enough to drive out or to put a serious crimp in the Therons' plans. And there's just other stuff going on that the Therons have to deal with. Barsave can be viewed historically. You talk about the Roman Empire dealing with Gallic uprisings or Britannia or things like that out at the frontiers. Not that Barsave is necessarily the frontier of the Theron Empire, but it is kind of a hinterland.
Indrisia.
It does not necessarily have the power and resources and unity that, say, Crayana or Talia or, you know, some of the others have, without having gone back to look at the books at exactly how those are.
Yeah.
I would say to a certain extent that while things are not necessarily ideal for them, Thera is doing reasonably well in Vasgothia. Aside from the weird magic stuff that's coming out of the Deep Forest, Thera is pretty well dominated Vasgothia, and certainly all of the majority of the land there, the civilized, quote-unquote, parts of Vasgothia are all Theron-controlled, and there is not the level of unrest or distrust of the Therons that you had in Barsave. Part of that may have to do with the folks that are in charge of running things there.
My group has an airship and is going to be doing a bit of traveling. I'm interested in what's going on in Turkey, which someone on the Discord called Anatolia. Why didn't the Therons conquer that area? What's up with that?
Well, Anatolia is not the name for that area in Earthdawn. That is, I believe, a historical name for that area. There is a little bit about that area in the original Theron Empire book as part of the Crayana chapter, I want to say. There's a map there that shows one or two cities that are up in that region. That's an area that sort of superficially or roughly would be adjacent to or connected with Rugaria province, which is one that has gotten very little description or development. There were plans at one point in the distant past of fourth edition to maybe have a Rugaria source book, but nothing ever ended up coming of that. So we don't know. It is a largely undeveloped area as far as official material has gone, aside from mentioning a city or two that maybe has a little bit of description in it in the Theron Empire book. They may have conquered it, and the reason that nothing has really been said about it is because they've conquered it and they pretty much have solid control of it, and that's that. I don't know. Like I said, there's a map, I think, in the Crayana chapter of the original Theron Empire book that points out a city or two there, but I don't know whether it's officially considered part of Rugaria province or whether it's its own territory or what the situation is. Because of Death's Sea and whatnot, it's tough to say exactly what's going on, and nobody has really expressed a whole lot of interest in exploring it at any particular length.
I keep coming back to all the Naaman Yaros cults. Why is this one hero such a big deal?
I don't know. Because it was?
Because that's how cults work?
Yeah. It was something that was put in as a reference in an first edition project at some point, and then got more development in the Secret Societies book. But the information that we have is the information that's there. Why does any particular hero or legend or person carry on? Understandably, perhaps, you know, you've got classic mythical figures like Odysseus or Heracles or the Monkey King that have all of these legends and stories about the amazing, awesome, weird, wacky, wonderful things that they got up to in their existences. And we don't really have that for Naaman Yaros within the official canon of Earthdawn. But that's because Earthdawn is a created world, as opposed to one that more organically developed in terms of a cultural tradition over the course of centuries.
Yeah. Well, and some of these things are just laced in here so that game masters can feel free to use and develop them on their own.
Yeah.
If they haven't been touched by the developers such as yourself. And so
I think the question is, in the case of Naaman Yaros, is why is this...
Why him?
...cult? Why is there a cult that is dedicated to the revival of this centuries gone hero? What is the story? Why is he so important to have generated this following? And the answer to that is, I'm not sure. I don't know that it's ever been significantly detailed. We didn't do a significant deep dive into every crevice of Earthdawn lore to check to see if there was some reference, but clearly it is important in some way.
Yeah.
Why that might be, I don't know. There's a little bit more, I guess, about Naaman Yaros in the Trevar book that I don't recall whether we talked about it in any great length, but I don't think there's a whole lot of detail there in terms of what the ancient background was either.
Maybe we'll...
Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah. In the meantime, feel free to come up with something if you want to use it.
For your game, yeah. Okay, that handles the quizzical part of our show. On to the sylvological part of our show. This is what it's like to try and survive and explore jungle areas. Because we covered mountains, especially during the whole Twilight Peaks in our deep dive into the Crystal Raiders. And then later on just on mountainous regions, because that was a nice place to start. So coming down in elevation, we're going to go through jungles. Not ourselves personally, because we're not going to fund that expedition.
I don't know. It's pretty swampy here where I am right now.
Yeah, it's nice and hot. Nice and hot. And I understand you've had a boatload of rain as well. So
yeah, it's been pretty wet. It was a pretty wet June for us here. We've had some decent weather, but we had a really rainy and hot and muggy kind of stretch of weather here.
Yeah. My state actually caught up on... my state actually had the most amount of rain it ever had in a June in 150 years. So...
Well, that's good considering Western water rights and stuff like that.
Yeah, we needed it. The thing to know about exploring jungle terrain, not that I've ever been in a jungle, but this is what the essay tells lore in the guide, is there is more life than any other in the habitat of the jungle. Just between the plants, the insects, the creatures, the people, everything else out there. There is more concentrated life in a square yard of jungle than there is in the plains, in the mountains, anywhere else.
Yeah. Forests, like especially even temperate rainforests like you have up in the Pacific Northwest, for example, can kind of give it a run for its money as well. But jungles and forests collectively are responsible for a significant portion of biodiversity on the planet. And even to this day, new species being discovered in the jungles and forests of the world, even in areas that you might think would otherwise have been reasonably well explored and
documented.
That's far from the case.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So the Servos word means alone, which is hilarious because there's two jungles in on the map, the Liege and the Servos. But the things to watch out for initially when you're thinking about going into the jungle at all is obviously lots of Tuskrang settlements and maybe even some Cathan human settlements. I mean, the fishing villages, the farming plantations, the jungle tribes, things like that. So those are some name givers to be aware of. We'll get to the tamers later when we cover the Liege a little bit. But really, the jungle has, aside from the name givers to watch out for, heat, as Josh pointed out, humidity, as Josh pointed out, and dirt, the foremost problems to have in the jungle because, say with me, Josh, water always wins.
Yes. Grand scheme of things, water as the universal solvent, as a persistent thing. You know, there's the classic folk tales and adages and whatnot about how water over time can seep into the cracks and eventually wear away and erode and crack and break down boulders and mountains. Water carries away, it erodes the landscape, it takes the dirt and soil away with it.
It is unrelenting.
Yes. Dealing with flash floods, we talked a little bit about that in the mountains as something that you need to watch out for if you're in canyons or anything like that.
But
water is super important, but like all things, if you have too much of it, it can be very, very dangerous.
Yeah, it causes rust, mildew, mold. Your paper will rot and fall apart. Paper will warp and tear, and your ink will bleed, and it will smear, and nothing good to anything you own in the jungle.
Yeah, broadly speaking, the jungle as a massive source of life and biodiversity, and with the ever-present moisture and humidity in the air, means that there are lots of things that are able to just grab a hold of things. Fungus, mushrooms, mildew, mold, plants, creeper vines, moss, algae, all sorts of things that are happy to take root on any surface. And if they can find some kind of sustenance out of it, they are happy to do so because they are tenacious.
Oh, yeah. So the other things to watch out for, we covered some of the just pervasive moisture. And then there's a little bit. There is also insects, disease, again, heat, because we're not going to beat that dead horse at all. And by the way, all this moisture around doesn't mean you can't be dehydrated.
One of the things that can happen, it's not even necessarily dehydration, although that is a hazard. It's heat stroke, because if you are in a hot, humid environment, the sweat on your body will not evaporate the way that it normally would to cool you down.
Mm-hmm.
And so consequently, it is possible to get overheated and to suffer from heat stroke and succumb to exhaustion a lot more easily because your body isn't able to regulate its temperature.
Yeah.
This is kind of the flip side of the cold and frostbite and hypothermia that we were talking about with the mountains.
Yes.
Really, there is a, relatively speaking, fairly narrow band of temperatures that humans or humankind is able to comfortably exist in. Being outside of that requires certain concessions to physics and biology.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's definitely something to keep in mind. Folks in the South, you know, we're talking Georgia, Mississippi, Louisiana, parts of Texas,
Alabama, Texas,
Florida, where you've got heat and humidity, the kind of things that can go on in those places in the summer, have a very strong familiarity with that kind of environment in a way that we had the familiarity with cold and snow and ice in winter.
Exactly. So I always like to throw these things in for game masters to use, so that they can paint a better word picture if they're writing something out or maybe coming up with a story. And for jungle terrain, there is very little underbrush. The resources are very scarce that low in the jungle. everything else is up high because there's tall trees, thick vines. There's an occasional swamp or swampy patch of thing to walk through, muddy ground. There's vines, mosses, and all the plants form a kind of canopy, a very large umbrella blocking a lot of the sun. So all the resources are up top. And so those branches kind of interweave and they make basically paths. And if you want two examples of that, you can look at Return of the Jedi for a movie or even Avatar, where they're walking along tree branches instead. And so that's two examples you can use where the Kathan tribesmen would also be in there. The Tuskrang would also be in there. And, you know, some other creatures, monkeys, tigers, birds of prey, snakes, whatever, would be coming from up above.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of stuff that you can go there. Going back to the same kind of ideas that we did in our episode about mountains and whatnot, there are endless documentaries and movies and videos talking about and exploring jungle areas, whether that is the Amazon basin in South America, whether you're talking about the equatorial jungles in Africa,
mm-hmm.
or yeah. the Southeast Asian jungles and whatnot along the coastline of Southeast Asia, Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia,
and
places like that, yeah, that all have quite a bit of jungle. And there is a certain amount, honestly, of that like sort of Southeast Asian influence that comes across in some of the first edition art about the Serbos jungle. Mm-hmm. Like I'm thinking of the Lost City art that's got the Tuskrang kind of discovering that overgrown ruin in the jungle. And
oh, yeah.
It's that kind of Southeast Asian mixed with perhaps a little bit of Mesoamerican, like Southern Mexico, Central America, the jungles having swallowed up the pyramids and that sort of thing.
That is the backdrop for our logo for the ADHD yes, podcast.
It is.
That's just why we picked it.
It's part of the reason why we picked it. Also, part of the reason we picked it was because I already kind of had it handy and it was already scaled to be sort of a background because it was the background image in a lot of the Game Master compendium from the classic era. But anyway, yeah. there's a lot of that sort of imagery and ideas that you can take. It's kind of pulpy, but look at the Tomb Raider games, particularly the more recent mm-hmm. reboots of them.
Yes.
Tomb Raider, Rise of the Tomb Raider, Shadow of the Tomb Raider, whatever they are, the most recent ones. The first yeah. one is kind of in like a Southeast Asian island situation. The third one is Mesoamerican
stuff. Cool. So there are
the Nathan Drake games as well, the Uncharted games, any kind of Indiana Jones inspired pulp adventure.
Yeah.
Is cool. There are some potentially problematic aspects of the history of things that go along with that. But, you know, in terms of media inspiration and adventure and locale descriptions, they're all pretty effective.
Exactly. So there's a little bit more flora to throw into the mix here. And not just penalty flora. There's some actual bonus flora you can get involved with. So just in case your party is foraging, don't forget to mention that there are nuts to be found, fruits, and mushrooms
that oh, yeah.
grow wild. And so this is, it's like I said, rife with life. So you can find some things to actually help your party as well.
Yeah. And on top of that, there are some parts on the edges of the Servos jungle where the land has to a certain extent been tamed and plantations, agricultural communities have sprung up to help leverage the bounty of the jungle in order to help provide food or other goods to Travar or other places like that. But yeah, again, with such a significant amount of biodiversity mm-hmm. and the web of life itself, there is quite a bit that one could find in order to survive within a jungle environment if you were somehow running low on food. You would still want to have somebody who is knowledgeable yeah. about such things. Wilderness survival would be very valuable here yes. because, of course, for everything that is there that you could eat to survive, there's probably twice as many that would make you sick or kill you if you were to be not careful about what it is that you ate.
Yeah.
And not even just foodstuffs, but
exactly
fantasy poison ivy, plants that have oils and various things on them that would cause you to break out into a rash or have an allergic reaction of some sort and make your life decidedly uncomfortable for encountering them, that may or may not have animals that are sort of in a symbiotic or relationship with them in some way that could be hazardous. Again, you're talking about fantasy genre taking existing plants that we know of in our world today and scaling them up and making them nastier in some sense.
Yeah. See our poisons episode. Nope. Gotcha.
Giant Venus flytrap things or pitcher plants that could certainly cause problems, especially for a windling that might fall into them. On top of all of the regular flora and fauna that you might have, you throw magic into the mix and you've got a whole nother level of stuff that can go on. Not to mention spirits.
Yeah.
Especially wood and plant spirits would be fairly abundant in an area like that.
Yep.
Could be leveraged or used or dealt with in some capacity by the residents of the jungle, whether the Tuskrang fishing villages or the Kathan tribesmen. The shaman discipline deals quite heavily with spirits, and so you'd have beast spirits as well that could be populated in such an area. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that could be there to deal with.
And then we've got two kind of, I can say, neutral things to point out as far as the flora is concerned. There's the Moidi tree leaves, M-O-Y-D-I, and those are some blue-green, and they are huge leaves. The smallest leaf could be basically a blanket for an orc, as it's described in the essay. So just a little flavor for your players to come across there. And then there's the Gnomsha tree. The wood of the Gnomsha tree, otherwise known as the iron root tree, can be fire-hardened and sharpened enough to rival steel. And so a lot of the Kathan tribesmen and the Tuskrang settlers and so forth, they will use Gnomsha tree wood for their weapons because they don't rust.
Yes.
They fire harden them and then oil them and they're all good.
Definitely something to keep in mind. And you can protect your weapons as well by keeping them protected and well oiled. As long as you are appropriately caring for your weapons, you should be okay. But long term, there's going to be a lot more effort that's required to keep weapons that you are using in that environment, steel weapons,
And the plant you just spoke of, the very large Venus flytrap, is called Ghost Jaws because it is invisible. It's magically invisible. And so it just waits for someone to come along and it will basically devour a name giver because it'll fit even a troll in its maw. And so that is a problem. The other plants that are there will also either crush you, strangle you, envelop you to smother you, and or some of the vines will strangle you because they might be living vines. And there is the one that's called the singing creeper, which basically just lures you to it by making this ghostly humming noise. And so the curiosity gets you to go to it, and then it'll do, you know, game master's discretion, knock yourself out. Have that one.
Yeah, there is a long, rich tradition in fantasy games of weird plant creatures or plant threats. One of the downsides of vegetation-based threats in a lot of cases is that they aren't particularly mobile. So once you are aware of them, it is generally not that difficult to avoid them or stay out of their way. A lot of them would be a kind of stationary ambush predator using disguise or illusion magic of some sort, perhaps, you know, innate illusions or camouflage to hide themselves in order to trap unwary prey that stumbles across their path.
So then there's the fauna, which we kind of have dabbled in a little bit here and there, but I have a small list for you of things you could find in the jungle. Again, rife with life here. Snakes, frogs, some deer, boar, lizards, some poisonous, some not, hunting cats, lightning lizards, magical ones, the skeorks, fire ants, monkeys, wyverns, tigers, lions, and bears, oh my, burrowing creatures, thundra beasts, monkeys.
Kuril. Yeah. You said burrowing animals, the Kuril, Earth Kuril.
And then, of course, if you think, well, maybe they're all out in the daytime, I'll just go at night. Well, then there's nocturnal predators. So,
Crogen, griffins, jungle and otherwise, other avian birds of prey type things. There's owls. Any number of...
Yeah, just...
Any number of critters that you can find there.
That's just a small list that I cobbled from the actual essay. I didn't actually go through all the books to find all the other ones, but that's just something to work with.
Yeah, Morgan on Panda Gaming Grove on his blog site has lists broken down by terrain of creatures within the Earthdawn books that are present. That's a place you can go to and look at the list and say, oh, yeah, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
That are appropriate here.
I think those need to be published because I've always loved games that actually have the random encounter tables. Here's the terrain you're in. Roll to see what you get.
Yeah, these aren't random encounter tables so much as just a list collating. These are all of the kinds of animals. And I think they might be sorted by challenge rating as well.
Yeah.
So that you can go, oh, I want to find a creature that in the jungle that could be a challenge for a party. Oh.
Yeah. Well done, Morgan.
That's him. He does very extensive collation and cross-referencing and stuff like that.
I would if I had the time. Well done, Morgan. No problem. But yes, tips for running those wild beasts are remember what they're motivated by, because they will only attack to either eat, protect, or escape pain. So maybe you come across one that's already trapped. Maybe you come across one who's ready to eat you. Or maybe you come across one who's trying to protect their young. Just three little examples right there. So knowing why that creature is going to attack and what for, maybe the fighting by the party can be avoided, but as long as the game master presents it well and has the motivation for that character, it's not just a stat block to hit.
Right.
Everything has its own story.
And outside of corrupted or cursed or otherwise strangely acting creatures for some reason, most wild animals, even magical ones, are not going to fight to the death. If a chosen prey puts up too much of a fight, they're likely to
run off,
decide to go and find a meal at an easier location. A parent protecting young is apt to be a little bit more vicious, but otherwise, again, these circumstances there, it's just going to try and cause as much confusion and pain to hopefully drive off the attacker the way that it would be driven off in order to protect the situation. It is a very straightforward environment in that regard. But ultimately, barring exceptional circumstances, which an adventure can be built around, right? You get a beastmaster who recognizes that something strange is going on in the behavior of this animal that they encountered could lead to a ruin or some kind of horror infestation or corruption or some kind of situation that's causing the animals to act strangely, potentially threatening a village or some other place that the player characters would then need to deal with. Or maybe it's just a sort of minor thing that provides a little bit of color as they are traveling through these environments.
Yeah, exactly. So one last little thing to note, the difference between a jungle and the forest is catch fire.
Yeah.
So if you're going to cast any fire spells in the jungle, you're pretty much safer than you would be if you cast fire spells in the forest.
And that's mainly just because of the amount of moisture in the area. Jungles will still burn, as the destruction of the Amazon basin indicates, if you get enough of it.
Yes.
It's just that forests generally are in an area where you will get cycles of wet and dry. And if you get an extended period of dry, then fires are more likely to happen. I mean, burns and whatnot are kind of a natural process of forests.
Yeah.
Clearing out the underbrush and is part of the cycle of life that exists in a natural forest.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it is definitely something to keep in mind.
Yes. And dealing with the animals, again, one last little bit, know those beasts' attack strategies. If it's a lone creature, know its attack strategy. If it's a pack animal, know those pack tactics. If it's a herd animal, they will just trample you. If it's a bird, it will swoop down. So get good at your downstrike rules or your swooping rules. Just make sure you have those handy. And then the last little thing, so that covers both jungles, Liege and Servos. The only difference the Liege jungle has is probably more spiders, but it also has some windling villages are in both of those, but...
The big thing about the Liege jungle that the Servos does not have is that the Liege jungle is the domain of Usun.
Yes.
The great dragon.
Who's gonna
get
there?
It is an area that is shaped in no insignificant part by the presence and magic of said dragon.
Yes.
And his philosophies on life as it is read in tooth and claw. So go back to our episode on Usun if you want a little bit more insight into that. And then in that jungle, you have the Tamers.
Yes.
Which are a...
It's a coalition of humans and elves who don't use weapons, don't wear clothes, don't have any creature comforts at all. So if you want reference for that, go watch the show Naked and Alone, but multiply it by 300 people or so. They do revere Usun, but he doesn't reciprocate this relationship.
Well, yes, he is in a sense the ultimate... predator. He is at the top of the food chain in the Liege jungle. The Tamers are challenging or living under the rules that he has established for his domain, in that they are, for lack of a better term, down at the base level of humankind, not having the extent of tools and civilization and whatnot that the rest of the world to an extent has been built up to. And so there is a kind of divine reverence of the Lord of the jungles and the life that is present there.
Exactly. So any further thoughts on jungle survivability or survival strategies?
Nothing specific. There is certainly a lot of terrain that is covered by the Servos jungle. It is a massive environment in the middle of Barsave.
Yeah.
And the Serpent River especially passes very close to it, kind of passes through its edge. But then there are a couple of tributaries of the Serpent, the Servos River being one of them, and its tributaries, as well as the Tylan River as well, is kind of on the western edge of the Servos jungle. And so if you are going to be dealing with the Tuskrang and river travel in that part of the world, you're going to be dealing, at least to some extent, with the Servos jungle. The Liege jungle is a bit less likely to become involved simply because of the nature of its domain and where it's located and how it is even more dangerous. It's kind of like the Mist Swamps in that it is an environment that is very dangerous on its own, but then you throw in... that it is essentially the lair of a dragon on top of that. But then, of course, there are plenty of other woodlands and forests that are throughout Barsave, particularly on the lower foothills and mountain slopes of places like the Thule Mountains or the Kakovic Mountains or the Thunder Mountains, you know, any of these places where you would have forests and such. A lot of what we said for the jungle holds for forests as well, if not necessarily quite to the same degree. But forest is a classic fantasy environment. Yeah. There is a long tradition folklorically of the old forest, of the deep forest.
We'll get to forests next time.
Yeah. You talk about like Hansel and Gretel and a lot of the European folklore.
Yeah.
Recorded and or sanitized by the Brothers Grimm, talking about the dangers of the forest and the forest as this kind of primal, dangerous space where it is very easy to get lost.
But we'll get to the next episode, because there's a difference between the Bloodwoods around there. So,
but again, we're not even talking necessarily about some of the special cases going on there, but it is something to keep in mind.
Absolutely. So, folks, until next time, don't forget to oil your weapons for your legend.
Good night, everybody.